Hello, and welcome to Season 4 of the Fashion Law Network podcast. I'm your host, Kasia Zabrowska-Traubin, a patent attorney and fashion enthusiast based in Los Angeles, California. Join me as I break down legal cases, discuss recent fashion news, and demystify patent law. Hello, and welcome to Season 4, Episode 7 of the Fashion Law Network podcast. I have a great episode for you guys, all about the luxury French fashion house of Balmain. Balmain was founded by Pierre Balmain back in 1945, and it currently operates 16 stores, including stores in Los Angeles, Miami, Milan, Vegas, and New York. And whenever I think of the Balmain Fashion House, I immediately think of their iconic structured blazer, and I'm sure many other people do too. It's really what the fashion house has become known for, especially in recent years. And it also helps that the Kardashians love Balmain, and they're seen in their blazers and structured dresses very often. And the fashion house has a major social media following. I will stick to my usual format for this podcast episode, where I begin with a brief history of the Balmain Fashion House. Then I'll go over some interesting patents and trademarks associated with the company. And then finally, I will provide my legal analysis of two intellectual property lawsuits involving Balmain. Now, the House of Balmain has been in the news recently, NFT news in particular, and as reported by Business Wire, with fashion embracing NFT drops in full force right now, Balmain is leading the way with a whole new NFT marketplace, Mint NFT, as its exclusive guide to a much larger decentralized dimension. The LA-based company is going to elevate the Balmain Fashion House in a future-friendly Web3, and this long-term global partnership was just announced on May 11, 2022. At the opening of Balmain's New York flagship store, which was attended by Balmain's creative director, Olivier Rousteig, and the Mint NFT co-founder, James Sun. So that'll be interesting to see how they change up the NFT game going on. And then there's one other kind of big Balmain news that has been on my radar, and this is sad and really disturbing. It was first reported by BBC.com, I believe, a few months ago, when French fashion designer Olivier Rousteig, he's the current creative director of Balmain, has been there for over a decade, revealed that he was injured following an accident at his home last year, and he shared a picture of himself in really heavy bandages. He shared this news in an Instagram post, and he wrote that the gas fireplace inside his house exploded and burned him. He said he woke up the next day at the Hôpital Saint-Louis in Paris, and he's been recovering from his injuries. He said his insecurities and fashion's obsession with perfection had stopped him from revealing all this information till now. He said he wasn't really sure why he was ashamed, but as he recovered, he said he hid his injuries with long sleeves and he would wear jewelries covering up his burn marks on his fingers during interviews. But now, a year later, he's healed, happy, and healthy. And if you look at a photo of the creative director now, you would never know he was in such a tragic accident not too long ago. So amazing that he was able to fully recover. So as I mentioned, the Balmain Fashion House was created back in 1945, and not many people know, but Balmain's classic blazer, that structured iconic blazer, was actually created in the 2000s to complement Pierre Balmain's classic design, which was a evening dress, and the blazer was meant to layer over the evening dress. The Balmain blazer currently runs about $2,500, I see on neimanmarcus.com today. And so it's definitely more of an investment piece, but one that I think you could wear with jeans or you could dress it up, and it just really is a timeless piece. According to historyofyesterday.com, Pierre Balmain founded the Maison Balmain as a couture house. And if you guys remember my brief history background of the House of Dior from my Dior episode, then you'll already know that Pierre Claudius Balmain worked with Christian Dior in Paris for the House of Lalong. But Bellman worked in various fashion houses for 11 years. So between 1934 to 45, he studied architecture in Paris. And most designers of that time, like Dior and Balenciaga, focus on the French market. And they kind of just focus on that French style. But Bellman was one of the first designers to see the potential of the American market. And he was kind of overlooked by other French designers sometimes, but his vision into the American market really propelled him into his level of popularity. The House of Bellman also had various perfumes, and despite selling the perfume business to Revlon in 1960, Pierre Bellman remained the chief designer of the House of Bellman until his death in 1982. The perfume business was quite a lucrative portion of the company, but the main priority was the couture part of the Bellman fashion house. Then 11 years later, so 1993, Oscar de la Renta became the main designer for Bellman, and he stayed with the company for 9 years. And then according to a historian about town.com, Christopher DeCarnan was creative director from 2006 to 2011, and he kind of went in a different direction. He really liked flashy designs, and he designed for a more expensive and flashy market. And then we have Olivier Rousteig, and he was the creative director after DeCarnan in 2011. He joined Bellman in 2009, and he was only in his early 20s. He previously worked under Roberto Cavalli, and he is still the creative director at Bellman to this day. So that's kind of rare to see a creative director at a fashion house for so long. He loves embellishments, major details in his designs, and there's also a really good fashion documentary that came out on Netflix last summer all about Olivier last summer. It was called Wonder Boy. And according to Hollywood Reporter, it follows a year in the life of Olivier, the current Bellman creative director. And it shows him from going to runway shows and going to houses of the celebrity clients like Kim Kardashian and Jennifer Lopez. But the main point of the movie is the designer's search to uncover the story of how he came to be adopted. And in the documentary, Olivier says he was raised in Bordeaux, which is a pretty conservative city in France, and that it was important for him to show the multicultural aspect that he has in his blood, as he is French, half Ethiopian, and half Somalian. So now that we have some background on the House of Bellman, we can discuss the patents and trademarks related to the company. And as usual, if you're a regular listener to the podcast series, you will already have heard this intro into patent and trademark law so many times, so feel free to fast forward this part about a minute to 90 seconds. So let's define what a patent is. It's a form of intellectual property that gives its owner the legal right to exclude others from making, using, or selling the invention for a certain amount of years, and that's in exchange for publishing a public disclosure of the invention. And to get your patent granted, your invention must be novel, useful, and unobvious. And you can even patent something that already exists as long as the improvement that you make to the original invention yields unexpected results. There are three types of patents. This is all under American law, of course, where I practice. You have a utility patent, which protects the way something works. For example, the mechanism of a novel pump on a cosmetic item. And then you have a design patent, which protects the ornamental nature of the item only. So the shape, the unique shape of a bag, for example, perhaps the way the strap is configured. And then the third type of patent is called a plant patent. It's relatively rare, and this is a patent that is granted to a person who has created or discovered new, distinct, and asexually propagated plants. Obviously, does not come up in the fashion context very often. So in researching Bellman patents on the United States Patent and Trademark Office patent database, I only see one design patent that is owned by the brand, and it was granted in May of 2021, and it is for an athletic shoe. according to the patent drawings, it looks like one of those really thick-soled, heavy sneakers, very similar to the Balenciaga Triple S sneakers, at least according to the drawings. I haven't seen this shoe in person, and the named inventor is Olivier, who is, of course, the creative director of the fashion house. And now let's move on to trademarks. So a trademark is a symbol, word, or words that can be legally registered or established by use as representing a company or product. You have a character or word mark and a logo. The word marks protect the actual word, the brand name of the company. So here it would be Balmain. And the logo is a symbol, of course, associated with the company. So here it would be the specific way that Balmain writes their company name with that fancy font for the B. And in searching Balmain trademarks on the USPTO database, I see there are many. The latest one being for perfumes, colognes, hair products, and other beauty products. And so that brings us to the legal analysis portion of this podcast episode. So the first one is not technically a lawsuit, but it's more of a situation of trademark, logo trademark infringement. There were no formal documents regarding a lawsuit filed, but there was an altercation and a reportedly amicable settlement. So it all started back in 2018 when Balmain redesigned their logo and wordmark. This was done by a Parisian studio called Adulte Adulte, and Olivier Roustig, the creative director we talked about earlier, also helped design this new logo and wordmark. And there was a mark for Balmain Paris in a distinct font, and also a new logo with a capital B and then an upside down P inside of that capital B, referencing the original founder, Pierre Balmain. And the new marks were quickly called out on social media for looking just like the logo of a Italian designer named Laura Biagotti that she had used for her fashion label. And the brand is still in business, and it's led by her daughter, Lavinia Biagotti. And the Laura Biagotti logo is a capital L and a B kind of together in black writing in a white square. And then looking at both the logos next to each other, they do look awfully similar. So once Balmain set out their new logos into the universe on their clothing and accessories, they started getting kind of called out online for this really similar logo with the Biagotti company. And a few months after that, it was announced that Balmain and Biagotti, and I'm quoting straight from this announcement that they gave here, they amicably solved any issue related to a possible interference between the new graphic design of the Balmain monogram and the LB logo of the Biagotti group. And then Balmain issued a statement that based on this agreement from the spring-summer 2020 collection, Balmain will start using a new version of its monogram, which will be presented to the general public on that occasion. And they seem to have done that because in looking up their logo now, it is different. So that's an interesting situation where a potential trademark infringement issue was resolved without the filing of a formal lawsuit. Also goes to show how important it is to do your due diligence before adopting a new logo or trademark for your company. You should definitely do a thorough search, because now look at how many losses Balmain had. They had to redesign their logo. They already had it printed on so many fashion items, so I'm sure they lost a lot of money on this change that they had to make. Now let's move on to a formal lawsuit that Balmain was involved with. It's titled Louis Ferrot International and Pierre Balmain, two consolidated plaintiffs versus Viewfinder Inc. And this is a copyright infringement case, which also deals with international copyright laws. And it's a somewhat older case. It was decided in 2007 by the Second Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. Plaintiffs in this case, Ferrod and Balmain, are of course French corporations that design high fashion clothing and other items for women. And according to casefinder.com, the defendant, Viewfinder, operates a website called firstview.com on which it posts photographs of fashion shows held by designers from around the world, including photographs of the plaintiff's fashion shows, so of Bellman fashion shows. And Donald Ashby is the president of this viewfinder company, and he's a professional fashion photographer. So Viewfinder likens itself to an internet fashion magazine, kind of like an online version of Vogue. And this First View website contains photographs of current season's fashions, and they can only be viewed upon a subscription and payment of a fee, and photographs of past collections, which are available for free. So a yearly subscription to First View costs $999, and then users can also view the content for 1 hour for $5.95. Viewfinder does not sell clothing or designs. So back in January of 2001, Bellman, along with several other design houses, each filed this lawsuit against Viewfinder in the Tribunal de Grande Instance de Paris, so this is the court in Paris, seeking money damages from Viewfinder for alleged unauthorized use of their intellectual property and unfair competition. These civil actions stemmed from Viewfinder displaying photographs of the designers' fashion shows, which revealed designs from their upcoming collection on that firstview.com website. Viewfinder was served in New York. They failed to respond to the complaints, and in May 2nd of 2001, the French court issued a default judgment against Viewfinder. The French court found that the plaintiff's ready-to-wear and haute couture collections from 96 to 01 were available on the First View website. Court further found that Viewfinder's postings of those photographs of plaintiff's designs was without the necessary authorization and constituted counterfeit and violation of royalties. The French court also found, with respect to each of the plaintiffs, that Viewfinder had committed, quote, parasitism under French law because it had taken advantage of Bellman's reputation and the commercial efforts, creating confusion between the two companies. I think what the French court is trying to say here, I didn't read the French court decision, but that they were afraid that the consumers were confused in thinking that perhaps Viewfinder and Bellman were working together in some way, or they had some sort of symbiotic relationship, which in fact was not the case. So then the French court ordered Viewfinder to remove the offending photographs and awarded damages of $500,000 for each plaintiff cost of action and a fine for each day that Viewfinder failed to comply with the judgment. And that fine was pretty hefty, 50,000 francs a day. This is before the euro, obviously. So then in 2003, Viewfinder appealed these judgments to the French appellate court in Paris, called the Cour d'appel de Paris, and the appellate court in France. But they subsequently withdrew their appeal without opposition after plaintiffs filed their brief. So then the French appellate court dismissed the appeal in February of 2004. Okay, now we're moving into the American side of this case. So in December of 2004, Bellman filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York to enforce that French judgment. So that damage of $500,000 plus that fine that Viewfinder was supposed to pay. And the district court consolidated the actions, granted plaintiff's request for an order of attachment. Okay, so then we move on to 2005. Viewfinder filed a motion to dismiss, or in the alternative, a motion for a summary judgment and a motion to vacate the attachment order. Viewfinder raised a variety of arguments in their documents, one of which was found meritorious by the district court. The district court found that enforcing the French judgments would be repugnant to the public policy of New York because it would violate Viewfinder's First Amendment rights. Specifically, the district court found that the fashion shows at issues were public events and that Viewfinder had a First Amendment right to publish the photographs at issue. So this is obviously very different than what the court in Paris found. And thus, as the district court concluded, the First Amendment simply does not permit plaintiffs to stage public events in which the general public has a considerable interest and then control the way in which the information about those events is disseminated in mass media. And that's a direct quote from that district court here. District court also stated that to the extent that plaintiffs' designs were protected by copyright, copyright law similarly provides the fair use exception for publication of noteworthy matters. And then the case finder website says that based on its conclusion that enforcing the judgment would impinge upon Viewfinder's free speech rights, the district court dismissed the action and vacated the order of attachment. So obviously Balmain and Farod were not happy with this decision and they appealed it. The question presented to the appeal was whether the district court properly found that the French judgments were unenforceable under New York law. And in reading the multi-page discussion of the appellate court's decision here, the appellate court ultimately decided to vacate the judgment of the district court and remand for further proceedings consistent with the opinion. The appellate court noted, among lots of other points, that, however, without development of the record, they can't reach any conclusions as to whether Viewfinder's conduct would fall within the protection of the fair use doctrine. The record is also unclear as to the manner of protection afforded Balmain's fashion shows by French law, as well as protections afforded to alleged infringers. There's also a really good law review article of this interesting case. It was written by Marquetta Trimble from the University of Las Vegas School of Law, which basically summarizes this case as, and I'm reading right from her article here, confirming a general theme at the intersection of intellectual property and private international law, notwithstanding a high level of copyright harmonization international level. There are still significant differences among the copyright regimes of individual countries that can result in a judgment of copyright infringement in one country being declared unenforceable in another country on the ground of repugnancy to public policy. So that is what the district court decided here, where they said that they can't enforce that French judgment. And that concludes this episode. As always, thank you so much for joining me, and please check back soon for the next episode. Have a wonderful day. Bye.